been to a dinner party where you sense the talk wasn't really a conversation as much as a series of monologues? First, somebody tells about their vacation, then maybe a dutiful but shallow question or two is asked. Then somebody else brags about his kid getting into medical school, which leads another guest to talk about her own college days, and on it goes, while eyes wander and heads begin to nod. You get the impression no one's really listening. Rather, they're just rehearsing what they might say. Maybe they're thinking about how to sound good or how strongly to make their points or how to outshine the others. As a result, by evening's end, everybody will have talked, but people really won't have communicated much or gotten to know each other very well. Poor listening is an acknowledged problem between employees and bosses, salespeople and customers, children and parents, husbands and wives. Lack of effective listening also leads to lost clients, lost political campaigns, and lost causes. In short, it leads to lost opportunities of every kind. In fact, leadership is practically impossible for the person who can't listen effectively. A University of Minnesota study showed that nearly 60% of misunderstandings in the business world could be traced to poor listening, and only 1% could be traced to written communication. Moreover, people view poor listeners as self-centered, disinterested, preoccupied, and aloof. On the positive side, learning to listen better can transform relationships by making others feel appreciated and valued. After researching this issue for the last 20-plus years, I've identified several categories of listeners. As I describe them, see if you recognize yourself or anyone you know. First is the non-listener. The non-listener is someone who doesn't actually hear the speaker at all. In fact, no real effort is made to hear what the other person is saying. Indeed, it's pretty obvious that this person is not really paying any attention. Blank stares and nervous mannerisms usually greet your attempt to make a point. Sometimes this person fakes attention while thinking about unrelated matters. But before long, it's clear that his or her attention is elsewhere. Non-listeners really want to do all or most of the speaking. They constantly interrupt and think they always must have the last word. They're usually considered social bores and know-it-alls, and they're typically disliked or, at best, merely tolerated. The marginal listener hears words, but not meaning and intent. Marginal listeners can't listen closely because they're too busy thinking about what they want to say next. They're easily distracted. In fact, many marginal listeners look for outside distractions as an excuse for pulling themselves away from the conversation. Marginal listening is especially dangerous because of the enormous possibility for misunderstanding. Because of this, it's a staple of television sitcoms and film comedies. But in real life, it isn't funny. Marginal listeners are insulting to the speaker because they merely feign interest. And all sorts of embarrassments can occur because the marginal listener doesn't really hear the speaker's message. The technical listener actively tries to hear what the speaker is saying. This is the label most of us would give the so-called good listeners. More concentration and attention are required at this level. However, technical listeners still don't make an effort to understand the speaker's intent. They tend to be logical listeners, more concerned about the content than the feelings. They judge the message merely on what's said, totally ignoring the part of the message that's carried in the speaker's vocal intonation, body language, and facial expressions. They're great with semantics, facts, statistics, but poor in terms of sensitivity, empathy, and true understanding. In other words, technical listeners believe that they understand the speaker, but the speaker doesn't feel understood. And our final category, the active listener. The active listener is unquestionably at the most powerful level of listening. Active listening is also the most demanding and the most tiring. The active listener refrains from judging the speaker's message and instead focuses on understanding his or her point of view. So active listeners concentrate on the thoughts and feelings of the speaker, including what's not being said, as well as concentrating on the actual words. To listen actively means suspending your personal thoughts and feelings. It means giving attention solely to the speaker. It means sending out verbal and nonverbal feedback that tells the speaker you're absorbing what's being said. This is important. If you expect to get the speaker's support, he or she needs to know that they're being heard. Once you've gotten into this habit of nudging yourself to listen better, extend this exercise to successive days with that same person, and then to other people as well. Listening well is a gift that you can give to others. It costs you nothing, but it may be invaluable to them. Second, create a receptive listening environment. Turn off the TV. Hold your calls. Put away your spreadsheets and silence your computer. Provide a private, quiet, comfortable setting where you sit side by side with others without distractions. Now, if that's not possible, perhaps suggest a later meeting in a more neutral, quieter environment. The point is to make your partner feel like you're there for him or her. Don't be like the boss who put a desk-sized model of a parking meter on his desk, then required employees to feed the meter, 10 cents for every 10 minutes of conversation. What kind of signal was he sending out? Third, if someone else is interrupting, avoid the temptation to reply in kind. It will just raise the level of acrimony and widen the gulf between you. Instead, be the one who shows restraint by listening to them and then quietly, calmly taking up where you left off. If you're talking, you aren't learning, President Lyndon Johnson used to say. And by showing more courtesy than the other person shows, you'll be quietly sending a message as to how you both ought to be acting. Fourth, be alert to your body language. What you do with your eyes, face, hands, arms, legs, and posture sends out signals as to whether you are or aren't listening, and whether you're understanding what the other person is saying. For example, what would you think if you noticed someone you were talking to glancing sideways, sighing, cleaning their fingernails, or fidgeting in their chair? You'd very quickly get the impression that no matter what words come from this person's mouth, he or she actually has zero interest in what you're talking about and wishes that you just go away. For similar reasons, you should abstain from judging. If you prejudge someone as shallow or ill-informed, you automatically cease paying attention to what they say. So a basic rule of listening is to judge only after you've heard and evaluated what they say. Don't jump to conclusions based on how they look or what you've heard about them or whether they're nervous or not. Next, be sensitive to emotional deaf spots. Deaf spots are words that make your mind wander or go off on a mental tangent. They automatically produce a mental barrier that impedes listening. Everybody is affected that way by certain words. For example, a speaker giving a talk to savings and loan personnel kept saying bank. To members of that industry, banks and savings and loans are very different things, and so each reference to them as bankers irritated the audience and aroused emotions that temporarily derailed their listening. So be alert to what your own deaf spots are and make adjustments. And try to find out what raises the hackles of other people, and then avoid those words so as to raise their likely level of listening. And finally, above all, create and use an active listening attitude. Learning to be an active listener is like learning to be an active jogger. It takes effort. You start little by little and work upward. It's as much a state of mind as a physical activity. Besides, as you work longer and get better, it pays ever-increasing benefits. An active listening attitude can help tremendously in breaking any poor listening habits. As a charismatic person, you must learn to appreciate the fact that listening is as powerful as speech. What someone says to you is just as critical as what you have to say to him or her. Realize that listening saves time and effort. Those who listen create fewer mistakes, fewer misunderstandings, and fewer false starts. And understand that listening is important and worthwhile to everybody. Look for the unique something that every person has to offer. By doing so, you can hugely increase your value to them and to the world as a whole, which is, after all, what charisma is all about. Every day, thousands of sights and sounds compete for our attention. The amount of stimuli we're exposed to is enormous and getting bigger all the time. 100 years ago, when most people still lived on farms and rarely ventured more than a few miles from their homes, being overstimulated by the environment wasn't really a problem. Now, of course, in the so-called information age, we're deluged by print and electronic images, not to mention the sheer numbers of people who come in and out of our lives. In this new environment, it's not always easy to make yourself heard. Suppose you take your boss aside and tell him about a great idea you have for a new software product. It's an offshoot of your firm's present line, and one you're sure could be easily produced. You expect your boss to be as jazzed about it as you are. Instead, he raises concerns about staff and funding and about timing and market. He questions whether foreign competitors couldn't make the same product more cheaply. All in all, his response sounds suspiciously like a brush-off. Why? Why are so many new ideas a tough sell? Isn't it true, as the old saying goes, that if you invent a better mousetrap, the world will beat a path to your door? In fact, that's never been less true than today, for a variety of reasons. For starters, people everywhere have become more savvy, skeptical, and even cynical. Even more importantly, many people just aren't skilled at the art of persuading. No matter how brilliant your idea, no matter how technically advanced or economically sound it might be, it will go nowhere unless you can get others to go along with it. And the only way you can do that is by persuading them, by communicating clearly why they really should want to do what you really need done. Skillful persuasion is a major building block of charisma. In this session, you'll learn some very specific techniques for persuading others to see things your way. And we'll take a good look at some of the barriers that often stand in the way of agreement. We'll start with a concept that I call the need gap, which is the difference between the current situation and the desired situation. Whenever you can cause people to perceive such a gap, there's a natural desire for them to want to fill it. Now, there's 4 steps for identifying and then closing the need gap and using it as a tool for persuasion. And by the way, this tool is universal. It can be applied to large social issues, let's say birth control or economic justice, or to more day-to-day challenges such as influencing your customers. The first step is exploring the important needs and goals. And this is done best by asking questions. Judge a man by his questions rather than by his answers, Voltaire said, and well-phrased questions are the mark of a skillful persuader. It's best to begin with open-ended questions, the kind that require a narrative for an answer. Open-ended questions encourage the other person to relax and to think broadly, even as they give you a chance to explore their need gap. Proper phrasing makes a big difference in the kind of answer you get. How's business will often get you a pat answer. Can you tell me a little bit about your business is a much better open question. Are you happy with your current mutual fund? Is not as good as, would you describe your current personal investment strategy? Can you tell me what's important to you in a home security system? Is likely to be much more productive than saying, so, you want a burglar alarm? Open questions don't lead the other person in a specific direction, but rather increase dialogue and show your interest in his or her current and desired situation. Once you've gathered information that paints a broad picture, you then can use closed questions to get specific facts. Let's suppose you're thinking about remodeling your home. The first contractor comes to your home and asks a few questions like, how old is the home? What areas do you want to remodel? Will you need financing? How much equity do you have in the house? When do you want to start work? Those are all reasonable closed questions that get the contractor some useful information. Then a second contractor arrives and asks questions like, could you tell me a little bit about your lifestyle? Which area of the home is your favorite and why? What do you hope to accomplish by getting this remodeling done? Then, in addition, he asks the same questions that the first contractor did. Which contractor would you hire? My guess is, all other things being equal, you'd be more influenced by the second contractor who started with open questions and then went to the specific close questions. He more fully engaged you in an exploration of your need gap. The first contractor will give you what you want, but the second contractor will give you what you really need. Redirecting questions are useful for steering the conversation in other directions. In essence, you're saying, I now have a good grasp of your point of view in this area, so now let's look at another area. These questions can change the topic or navigate a difficult exchange towards smoother waters. For example, after hearing all about the furniture, drapery, and carpet choices planned for a remodeled family room, the contractor could gently steer the conversation back toward the overall design. Or, to get feedback on a different issue, you could ask a potential donor this question. One of the things that the Alumni Fund is supporting is more research and development for growing crops organically. Since you majored in agriculture, how would that interest you? Using questions makes persuasion more of a collaborative experience. Remember, increasing your persuasiveness is not an exercise in exerting power over people. Some people may still cling to the old image of using verbal domination to get others to see things their way, but it doesn't work that way in the real world anymore, if it ever did. When you're trying to persuade somebody, there's more than one possible course of action. So in most cases, you'll want to involve the other person in exploring ways to close the need gap. That is, getting their current situation more in line with their desired situation. If they're helping create the solution, they'll be far more committed to implementing it than if you alone create the plan and, in essence, inflict your solution on them. For instance, if you're a real estate salesperson, you may find a great home that meets a family's living requirements, but it may not meet their criteria for quality of the schools or access to shopping. Or you may be able to meet all the requirements, including schools and shopping, but not at the right price. By collaborating with your customers with a give and take between options and trade-offs, you can help solve the problem by getting them to detail their priorities, telling you which of the factors are most critical to their plan. If you're trying to round up volunteers to help out in a poor neighborhood, and you're speaking with someone who's already expressed interest, don't tell the person what he'll be doing. Instead, ask him what he'd feel most comfortable doing and what actions he feels will make the most difference. That might be helping kids learn to read, or repairing broken windows, or getting inoculations for people at risk. That way, you'll help establish mutual respect and trust. Trust, says management author and speaker Gordon Shea, is the miracle ingredient in organizational life. It's a lubricant that reduces friction, a bonding agent that glues together disparate parts, a catalyst that facilitates action. The point is, you want to make others feel that they have a part in the solution, not just feel as if they were coerced or manipulated. Coercing someone into following your suggestions may get you what you want in the short term, but in the long term, you definitely will lose. The third step of the persuasion process is commitment and implementation of the mutually agreed upon action plan. If yours is a simple sale or other act of persuasion, if a yes or no is all that's required, action's immediate. But if what you're seeking requires several steps or phases, you'll need agreement on how you're going to proceed. Doctors, for example, often complain that patients don't get well because they don't fully follow the prescription directions. When the patient starts feeling a little bit better, he or she may stop taking the medicine. Maybe the doctor needs to take the time to explain the action of the drugs in relationship to the problem. The symptoms of a sore throat can be alleviated in 2 days with an antibiotic, the physician might say. But the germs may remain for days afterward, and they need to be controlled. Patients who understand the process are much more likely to carry out the plan. During this third step, make sure the other person clearly understands the benefits of implementation. Have them restate the benefits and what it's going to take to get them. For instance, the contractor might encourage the customer to say, if I invest $10,000 in this remodeling plan now, My house not only will be worth more when it comes time to sell it, I'll also save between $500 to $700 a year in heating costs. It's important to verify that the other person understands the obligations and rewards if he or she takes the action that you suggest. If someone has agreed to serve on your nonprofit board, for instance, make sure that she knows what's expected of her, how many meetings she'll have to attend, how much fundraising she might have to do, and how much cooperation she can expect from the executive director. Like snowflakes, people are different. There's no other person in the world exactly like me or exactly like you. That definitely makes life more interesting, but also more difficult at times. Most of us don't try very hard to understand others. We scratch our heads in puzzlement at those who are unlike us, and then we bumble along, pretty much resigned to the fact that a lot of people out there are just, well, different, odd, maybe even weird. So we ignore them, or deal with them as little as possible, often to our detriment. But when we fail to understand others, when we just assume they ought to be more like us, we create tension and discomfort, otherwise known as personality conflicts. You can reduce or eliminate those conflicts by learning to understand behavioral styles, including your own. The flexibility dimension of charisma involves your personal attitudes toward yourself, others, and the situations you face. It indicates your degree of willingness to change your perspective and/or your position when it's appropriate. In this session, we'll focus on five positive traits for flexibility. These are the ones that you want to cultivate. They are confidence, tolerance, empathy, positiveness, and respect for others. Now let's look at each five of these positive traits in detail. Having confidence means that you believe in yourself, that you trust your own judgment and resourcefulness. In his many books on the subject, Dr. Nathaniel Brandon defines self-esteem as the sum of self-confidence and self-respect. For him, self-confidence is knowing that you have the wherewithal to function reasonably well in the world, even in the face of criticism, setbacks, and occasional outright failure. Confidence in yourself gets built up over time. You can fake confidence, and you may need to at first, but real self-confidence comes from a history of small victories and accomplishments that add up to a sense that you can handle yourself well in most every situation. I suggest that you take an inventory of the major accomplishments that you've achieved over the past few years. Then remind yourself of the minor ones, too. What about the computer course you completed? Have you built anything that's still standing? What about those kids that you're raising? That's an accomplishment. Don't be modest. Tell the truth about how hard you worked, what sacrifices you've made, and if you can't think of any, then begin by congratulating yourself for living as long as you have. Sure, survival is an accomplishment these days. Seriously, it pays to take the time to know your strengths and appreciate them. What's unique about you? What skills do you bring to an organization or to a project that you can count on? Confidence is a fundamental trait of flexibility in particular, and of charisma in general. It's hard to be charismatic when you're fearful or easily intimidated. Confidence is indispensable if you want to engage someone's attention. Flexibility trait number two is tolerance. Tolerance means that you're open to accepting opinions and practices that are different from your own. We can easily get images of people who are intolerant of other people because of religious or political beliefs, or who differ in race, gender, or sexual orientation. Those intolerant folks may attract like-minded people, but they don't get the attention of a diverse audience. Now, we all have grown up with stereotypes of people who are different from us. How embedded they are depends a lot on our upbringing. An early start on tolerance for differences is a great gift that a parent can give to a child. But unfortunately, we don't all start out that way. Some of us have to learn tolerance and get more skillful at it. Remember that flexibility means that you're willing to adapt your behavior. You're less apt to do that with an intolerant attitude toward the other person. Intolerance is a double-edged sword. It may keep those people you don't like at a distance, but it isolates you within a minority group. And everybody belongs to some minority. Even white heterosexual males are a minority. We're in a world that's increasingly recognizing the values of cultural, racial, and gender diversity. The third positive flexibility trait is empathy. The root of the word empathy is pathos, the Greek word for feeling. Sympathy means acknowledging the feelings of someone else, as in, I sympathize with you. Empathy is a term for a deeper feeling. It means, I feel what you feel. I can put myself in your shoes. Sympathy results in kindness and sometimes pity. Empathy results in actually feeling the pain or the joy of the other person. Empathy is much easier to come by when you care about the other person and take the time to feel what they're feeling. In the worlds of business, politics, or the professions, that feeling of empathy might not come as easily. But one thing is certain, you cannot truly feel the pain or the joy or the emotion of another until and unless you're able to feel the same thing in yourself. Do you acknowledge your own pain? Can you feel your own joy? Real empathy lies in simply finding the same place within yourself that the other person is experiencing. You might not have had exactly the same experience, but you've known the sadness of loss or the anger of feeling cheated or the sense of righteousness at injustice. Some of us don't take the time to feel our own feelings, so when someone else expresses a feeling, we don't have much to refer to. The fourth aspect of charismatic flexibility is positiveness. It means maintaining a state of positive expectations about people and situations, including a positive state of energy in your thoughts and emotional patterns. Dr. Norman Vincent Peale's book, The Power of Positive Thinking, was published over 40 years ago, and it continues to sell well because it contains such a universal truth. The attitudes we hold help to shape the reality we experience. Having a positive attitude isn't something you just tack on to your old personality. That positiveness isn't external like a new suit. It comes from deep within you. It has to, or it would get wiped out with the first sign of a countervailing negative force. Positiveness is built on having your own positive life philosophy, on knowing what strengths you have, and on surrounding yourself with other sources of positiveness. Many of us haven't taken the time to consider what our own life philosophy is. If you haven't, it doesn't mean you don't have one. You're just operating from it unconsciously. By life philosophy, I mean, in simple terms, something like, I know I'm here to live up to my potential, to make a contribution to society, and to have a good time. Now, someone else might say, I'm here to serve God through being of service to my fellow human beings. And a third philosophy might be, I'm here to show others that despite physical handicaps, you can lead a productive life and enjoy what you have. Your personal philosophy can contain a vision such as, I'm here to save the planet from environmental destruction, or I'm a valuable member of a company that's improving the way human beings communicate with one another. Your philosophy acknowledges who you are and what your purpose is for being alive. A truly positive philosophy, one that's motivating, encompasses more than just you. The fifth positive flexibility trait that we'll consider is respect for others. I call it practicing the platinum rule. Do unto others as they would like done unto them. This is an extremely important rule in a world where not everybody wants to be treated the same way, and where people expect their differences to be honored. The platinum rule, distilled to its essence, equates to respect for others. It's a means of breaking down the them versus us mentality, and it concentrates on the us. It's a potent tool for helping build your charisma by meeting the other person's needs, as well as fulfilling your own. The trait of respect for others can be narrowly interpreted as live and let live. That philosophy is giving way to a larger interpretation that breaks down the old us and them mentality and leads us to the conclusion that there's only us. The five positive traits of flexibility we're considering are necessary not only for your day-to-day dealings with other people, but also they're traits which we all need to cultivate as a basis for a new living arrangement in the 21st century. A living arrangement which recognizes that we're all one people, living on one planet. It's clear that the values of competition and individual achievement can only take us so far. They have to be balanced with the bedrock values of cooperation and concern for the whole. Many people have come to see how foolish it is to try to have one set of moral values one day of the week and then to operate from a totally different set of values the rest of the week. We need to be consistently ourselves 7 days a week. How much better would you feel if you were more consistently confident about yourself? More tolerant of the differences and diversity among people? If you had more empathy for the pain of others? If you more often than not sourced your strength in the positive rather than the negative? And if your respect for people extended to caring about if they were being treated well by you? All of these are vital elements of flexibility, and flexibility is a vital component of charisma. Flexibility doesn't mean imitating another person's style or pretending to be someone you're not, but it does mean being willing and able to bend a bit if that's what it takes to make a better relationship. It's a way to work better with a specific person or within a specific situation. It means thinking before you act. It means not just doing or saying the first thing that comes to your mind. In the next session, we'll look further at dealing with people as they want to be dealt with and how you can ensure a win-win relationship that will benefit everyone. Now, if that's not charisma, I don't know what is. Your spiritual self is a bit like the concept of charisma itself. It's difficult to say exactly where or what it is, but we know it's there. It's the aspect of ourselves that has an identity beyond what we own or what we do, or even beyond the identity of our physical bodies. Science, after all, tells us that every cell in the body is replaced at least once every 7 years, and many of them a lot sooner than that. So there's not a single cell in your body that was there 7 years ago, but you're still the same you, even though you're a totally different you. And somewhere in there is the reality of your spiritual self. None of this has anything to do with how often you go to church or whether you have a Christmas tree. Religion is a choice. What I'm talking about is your spiritual identity. The purpose of this session is to help you learn to use it in a productive and charismatic way, to create a positive energy between you and the people you're seeking to influence, an energy that exists beyond job titles or levels of authority. Spirituality is the bond of trust that you're able to create with others, the level of caring and the attitude of service that you convey, and the sense of higher purpose or greater good that you communicate. It's the opposite of self-centeredness. It's the belief in people that enables them and inspires them to believe in you. There is evidence that these kinds of spiritual issues are becoming more important in all areas of our national life, in business, in healthcare, and even in how we see relationships between family and friends. For example, more than 40 of the nation's 126 accredited medical schools now offer courses on the spiritual elements of clinical care. As one leading healthcare administrator put it, 5 years ago, less than a half a dozen medical schools were offering these courses, but that all has changed. This is a major shift as doctors face the challenge of treating the whole person, body, mind, and spirit. Often, but not always, interest in spiritual issues draws on the rituals and scriptures of traditional religion. An article in Business Week estimates that more than 10,000 Bible and prayer groups meet regularly in workplaces. The number of new books each year connecting spirituality with career and success has quadrupled since 1990. And at Harvard Divinity School, a full-time faculty member specializes in business ethics. There are many reasons why all this is happening, but as a charismatic leader and a human being, there's one very important factor that you should be aware of. Connecting with people on a spiritual level just plain works. People are happier and more productive. They work harder and longer, and they do so by choice, not coercion. This has been born out of careful research. One study showed that when companies engage in programs that use spiritual techniques for their employees, productivity improves and turnover is greatly reduced. When people work for organizations that they consider to be spiritually oriented, they're less fearful, less likely to compromise their values, and more able to devote themselves to their work. According to a professor at the University of Southern California School of Business, spirituality could be the ultimate competitive advantage. Along with the widespread interest in spiritual development, there is a cautionary note. People do not want to have any one point of view forced upon them. They want to select the form of their spiritual explorations and practices for themselves. Perhaps more than any other area of their lives, they're uncomfortable with externally distracted observances and restrictions. With this in mind, the principle that I call the Platinum Rule seems especially important here. The Golden Rule, of course, is an ancient wisdom that has its roots in the Old Testament and was most clearly articulated by Jesus in the New Testament Gospel of Matthew. The Golden Rule tells us to do unto others as we would have them do unto us. But the world has grown so diverse and so fast-changing that it's just possible that others might want to be treated very differently from what we might want for ourselves, particularly with regard to spiritual issues. The Platinum Rule, therefore, teaches us to do unto others as they would like done unto them. It's a more outwardly focused principle that depends less on introspection and more on connection with the wants and the needs of other people. But more importantly, it's based on the recognition that people are not the same and they don't want to be treated the same. In addition to their personal characteristics, the nature of your relationship with different individuals is also a major determining factor. You might relate to your second cousin from Minnesota in a certain way when you meet her at a family reunion, but the expectations would be very different if you met in the workplace or in a doctor's office. The sooner you recognize these variables and act upon them, the more you'll be perceived as a caring and charismatic person yourself. We've seen how clear understanding of other people is essential to charisma and true spirituality. Understanding is a precondition for implementing the Platinum Rule. And it's interesting to note that understanding does not include judgment. The rule does not tell us to treat people as they would like to be treated, provided they deserve it. It does not include an escape clause that says, unless they've done something that annoys you. That's what makes it so very challenging. The Platinum Rule is counterintuitive. Our default mechanism is to react rather than proact, to respond to our perceptions rather than create a new perspective. But for most people, charismatic behavior is not intuitive, at least not at first. It takes conscious attention. Initially, it's an aspiration rather than an instinct. Worthy aspiration, in fact, is the second principle of charisma and spirituality. When you interact with someone in a serious way, what is it that you really hope to do? There's no one-size-fits-all answer for this, of course. Sometimes we're talking with someone purely out of self-interest, most of the time, perhaps. We want something from them, and there's a good chance they want something from us. There's nothing inherently wrong with that. It's how the world works, and it's how things get done. But spirituality implies a different agenda. You may want a new Mercedes or a bi-coastal lifestyle, but those are not really spiritual aspirations. You may communicate with someone in order to get him or her on your side for an important project, but that is not communication on a spiritual level. I think this principle can be expressed very simply. Worthy aspirations, spiritually speaking, are based on giving, not getting. When you interact with someone in this way, it comes from a desire to give or to share rather than to acquire anything for yourself. Once again, this is not to say that getting is wrong, but we're always trying to get. Spiritual charisma means that you're aspiring exclusively to give for a change. Here, the seemingly paradoxical concept of servant leadership can be especially useful. It's the flip side of the conventional leader, the leader who tells other people what to do and who receives all sorts of recognition and awards for doing it, whether it's salary or honorary degrees or Gulfstream jets. But servant leaders know what they've accomplished in the past, and they're not really interested in revisiting that. Servant leadership looks forward. There's nothing honorary about it. It's not based on what you've done in the past. It's focused on the future. How can anyone be charismatic when their whole authority is based on what derives from what happened yesterday? Servant leadership is based on this principle of worthy aspiration, a word that's derived from spirit, by the way. The third component of spiritual charisma is the ability to communicate well, not just effectively in the sense of clarity or persuasion power, but well in the sense of being able to express things that are difficult to talk about, to know how to do this and when to do it, to touch on something in other people that is usually ignored. All great spiritual leaders had this power. You can feel it by reading the Sermon on the Mount in the New Testament, and you can hear it in the speeches of Martin Luther King Jr. The ability to connect with people one-on-one at a spiritual level, and somehow doing that even if you're speaking to a huge crowd. It can't be done in a carefully prepared, finely tuned manner the way a speech can. It's intuitive, and it's improvisational, knowing just what needs to be said at a unique moment in time. What does spiritually beneficial action include? Let's talk about helping people who are less fortunate than you. It can take the form of giving money or time or professional expertise. There are many things that you can do and many things that you can give. But in order for them to really be spiritually beneficial, what you do may be less important than why you do it. Intention, in other words, is extremely significant. Now, in order to make this clear, let's use the word charity for a moment. Let's say that you perform an act of charity. What are your intentions? And what should your intentions be from a spiritual point of view? The unfortunate fact is, for many people, acts of charity are performed for a very few simple reasons. They want to feel good about themselves. They want to bring benefit to others, but they don't want to really go overboard to the point that their good deeds really cause them any discomfort. Maybe that's the difference between charity and some higher level of spiritual action, something like self-sacrifice or even martyrdom. Because an important point of charity was to make the giver feel good, right? Well, in terms of charisma and truly spiritual action, if an action doesn't cause you discomfort, if it isn't really a stretch in a positive and giving direction, we have to question how valuable it really is. Spiritually speaking, the important thing about charity is less what it does for the receiver than what it does for the giver. And in order for it to really do something for the giver, it has to be a stretch. And ideally, it should be a painful stretch. In fact, no pain, no gain. The more painful it is, the greater the spiritual value. This is the irony of spiritual action. On the surface, it's for the benefit of others, and it should benefit them in tangible ways. But self-interest is really the basis of spiritually correct action. We don't benefit from it materially, but we benefit at the level of our souls. This leads into the concept of spiritually correct effort. And by effort, we mean work. The spirit requires work, just like the body. Use it or lose it. But what's great about spiritual effort is you can do the work at any and at all times. We can't always control what's going on in our lives, but we can always control and seek to improve our responses and reactions. We live for the good things in life, but it's the hard things that show who we really are, or maybe not the difficulties themselves, but how we deal with them. Among the ancient Greek Olympic athletes, there was a philosophy that when difficulty arose, we should remember that the world, like a physical trainer, matches us with opponents in order to make us stronger. And why does the world want to make us stronger? Not to destroy us, but so that we can become champions. And that cannot happen without sweat. It can't happen without attention and awareness of the larger picture and of the benefits and opportunities that every obstacle contains. This awareness is the final quality of spiritual charisma. It's an awareness that all the events of our lives are really taking place on two levels at the same time. Mostly, we're focused on the worldly level. What will this do for my career? How can this benefit my income or my retirement plan? But a spiritual person is aware of the other level as well. How important will all this be 100 years from now, or even 10 years from now? How will this specific action help other people besides myself? And if it doesn't help anyone else, how worthwhile is it, really? Spiritual charisma means being aware of all those kinds of issues and making others aware of them in a positive way. It's not easy. It's not about being a preacher. It's about being a genuinely caring and charismatic person. Can you see how this final quality of heightened awareness circles back to the first one, which is understanding? Spirituality is like that. The end always connects back to the beginning. A charismatic person looks for those kinds of connections and symmetries. To be as charismatic as you can, to send out the best silent messages you can, you need to be alert to the spiritual needs of others as well as yourself. That takes a well-tuned antenna. But such sensitivity is a sign of character and decency and integrity and, most of all, charisma. In many ways, possessing vision is the key to all other aspects of charisma. Mastering the other elements but lacking vision is like being all dressed up with no place to go. Being supremely able to communicate, adapt, and persuade, as well as send out a positive image, is wonderful. But having a vision, a sense of what you want and need to do, gives purpose and unity to the other aspects of your charisma. You might think of your total charisma as a locomotive. If the first 9 elements are the wheels, then vision is the engine. If the wheels are on track, the engine, the vision, can turn them, taking you where you want to go. So what do you feel passionately about? What do you really care deeply about? Whatever your objective, you'll never influence anyone to change their ideas or take action if you don't feel strongly about it yourself. How do you get such a passionate vision? Well, the process probably varies somewhat from person to person, but I believe that there are 3 stages to arriving at a vision that will help make you a charismatic leader. The first is your defining moment. That's when, as the saying goes, the light bulb goes on. Something clicks in your skull. You realize that you're onto something really exciting. Some years ago, for example, that is what happened to Robert L. Johnson, a black businessman who worked for the National Cable Television Association, that something was going to target black media consumers. I figured, he later said, why not me? An associate describes Johnson this way. He's the kind of person who is able to create a vision or an idea of what he wants to accomplish, and once he has, he's fantastic at persuading other business people to support him. Johnson's BET Holdings, for Black Entertainment Television, aims to be to African American consumers what the Walt Disney Company is to families in general. And already, BET reaches 40 million households. Meanwhile, Johnson is transferring the BET brand to magazines, radio, film production, electronic retailing, and other interests. Aiming at becoming a one-stop shopping spot for advertisers to reach Black consumers, BET employs 450 people and brings in $115 million in sales, all from Robert Johnson's idea that there was a need for Black programming and his "why not me" approach. To get anything significant accomplished, you must see the need, as well as work hard, possess energy, and demonstrate drive. But to truly influence others, you also need a mission. That's the second stage of fashioning a vision. It's what gives purpose, context, and stamina to your defining moment. It isn't enough just to come up with a mission statement that merely sounds good or looks sharp on paper or in an annual report, though that's a start. Instead, to be effective, your mission statement has got to come from your heart. It's got to grow out of a sense of what's important in your life and in your world. The deeper your passion for the mission, the more it will attract others, thus enhancing your charisma. There's a characteristic that many of the most effective missions have in common. They were created to serve others. When people or companies think only of how many units they can produce or sell, something happens to the spirit. A case in point. For too many years, Detroit automakers focused on how many cars they could sell rather than on how well they could serve the American people with quality transportation. And as a result, the domestic auto industry was almost destroyed. But it came back strong when the focus shifted to quality rather than mere numbers. Maybe we can't all have missions echoing the grand but simple nobility espoused by Salvation Army founder William Booth. It simply said, others. But we can all look outside ourselves as we try to figure out our life's purpose. And looking outside ourselves will not only help us fashion a mission, but it will also help draw people to us and enhance our charisma. I've always heard it said that there's three kinds of people: those who make things happen, those who have things happen to them, and those who wonder, what happened? The purpose of this program is to help propel yourself into that first category. You can increase your charisma and, in large measure, take control of your destiny. As I've sought to show, you already have everything you need. Now it's up to you to take those ingredients and build the best you possible. The fact that you've gotten this far suggests that you're already motivated. But the task now is to follow through and not let your zest for self-improvement fade as we near the close of this program. Success does not come to those who wait, and it doesn't wait for anyone to come to it. I've given you a lot of improvement ideas, and it's true that some of them are difficult to carry out, requiring changing years of habit. Just hearing about the possibilities, though, won't make them come true. That's like leaving the porch light on for Jimmy Hoffa, a well-meaning exercise in false hope. So my next and final step is to nudge you toward a vigorous, consistent follow-up. I've already recommended ways to improve all five aspects of your silent message or image: how to speak well, how to listen more intently, how to be a better persuader or motivator, how to be flexible, how to adapt to different personalities, and how to expand your vision and ideas. In this final section of this last session, I'm going to toss out a few more suggestions to underscore those ideas. I'll try to do so a bit lightheartedly so you don't feel that I'm nagging you, but rather I hope you feel that I'm grabbing your attention and launching you toward new levels of charismatic power. Suggestion number one: you are who you think you are. Speaking of people with charismatic power, You need to realize that you are one. Hold that positive image. What you see is what you become. So make charismatic a mandatory part of your private self-description and visualize yourself exuding personal magnetism. This is important because you're the first person you need to convince. Do that and you're on your way. I'm reminded of a story Katharine Hepburn told about breaking into Hollywood in the 30s. She was a tall, coltish New England actress of aristocratic bearing at a time when the norm for female movie stars tended toward the small, sweet, and cuddly. But she was confident and had a good self-image that, she recalled, she thrust herself on the movie colony as though I were a basket of flowers. What a wonderful image! Her sense of self was so strong that she could imagine offering herself up as a sort of gift of beauty and grace. And of course, it worked. Again, having a winning self-image precedes success. It doesn't follow it. And the Hepburn story again shows that. Suggestion number two. Your influence has never mattered more. It's easy to fall prey to cynical or pessimistic thoughts and axioms such as them that has, gets, or leaders are born, not made. But the truth is, that's nonsense. If those with so-called natural ability to influence others don't cultivate the right skills, they fall short of their potential. Give me a person without the supposed natural talent, and let me train him or her in the skills in this program, and I'll put my money on that person every single time. What's more, as I mentioned, such skills have never been more in demand. If you can develop your charisma, you'll likely be a hot property. As recently as a decade or two ago, that wasn't necessarily true. Then, in business and elsewhere, we had strict hierarchies where everyone knew his or her role and automatically followed the boss's lead. Surprise! That's no longer true. The command and control structure largely went out with dial phones and leisure suits. Whether you're talking about businesses, churches, community groups, civic associations, or even athletic teams, autocracy is waning. Personal power is eclipsing position power. And the key to personal power is not issuing edicts, but galvanizing people, inspiring them, persuading them. So all in all, we're lucky to be living now when life is more fluid and we can more readily make our influence felt. Suggestion number three. Apathy is a major social problem, but who cares? Actually, we all should care, because it's enthusiasm, not apathy, that makes the world go round. Setting yourself on fire with enthusiasm will fuel your charisma. But enthusiasm doesn't necessarily mean that you must be an extrovert. The directors and socializers mentioned in session 10 are naturally enthusiastic people, and of course, they're extroverts. But that doesn't mean that you relators and thinkers have been handed a life sentence of apathy. It just means that you'll go about the business of being enthusiastic from a different angle. Being enthusiastic isn't merely talking energetically and gesturing wildly about your passion. It can, in fact, take a quieter path. Maybe your enthusiasm is revealed by the earnestness and persistence with which you seek to get others involved. Maybe it's shown by your strength of commitment, your refusal to become discouraged. Maybe it's that spark in your eye or that warm smile and the unmistakable genuineness that emanates from you as you explain again and again your mission. Suggestion number four. Wherever you are, there you are. Most of us will never lead revolutions or turn around ailing corporations or start new social movements, but the basic tools of charisma are available and useful in small arenas as well as large. In short, don't think that you can only use the skills I've mentioned if you're a big shot, like a manager, a department head, or a member of the board of directors. Whether you're a peon or a potentate, you have the potential to be influential. Maybe it's only at the board meeting of the local Little League or at the PTA. But by radiating a powerful silent message, by speaking and listening well, By being an effective persuader and being flexible and adaptable to other personality styles, and by expanding your vision and ideas, you'll be well served whatever the venue. A person who could never be a Lee Iacocca on the national stage could enjoy something like his success, say, at the neighborhood watch level, or at the school board level, or in running the family shoe repair business. Look for available opportunities, regardless of the magnitude. That's what Art Fry did. He was just a 3M scientist singing in his church choir some 20 years ago and having trouble marking his space in the hymnal. Little pieces of paper would fall out, but bending the pages or marking them with paper clips or other devices was too permanent or too damaging. What he needed was something that would be easy to see, would stay put, but be readily removable when no longer needed. He dreamed up an idea on his own time and then convinced his firm's higher-ups of the commercial possibilities. The result? Fry didn't have any more trouble keeping his place in the hymnal, and the world got Post-it notes, now a ubiquitous office tool and practically a household word. Suggestion number 5, write your obituary. Seriously, write it. Actually sitting down and writing it can be a marvelous exercise in goal setting. Make it long and detailed. After all, you are a person with extraordinary charisma. Your obituary can become your script, telling who you were, what you did, how well you were liked. If you're like most people, you'll first list your accomplishments, successes, and positions in organizations. Then you'll revise your obituary, realizing that what you want to be most remembered for is not how many initials you had after your name or how many employees were beneath you on the organization chart. Rather, you'll probably want your life story to be about your character. What useful things did you do? How good a friend were you? What kind of partner? How well did you behave in crises? Write it. But understand that the only real way to have the sort of obituary that you want is to start living the way you'd like to be remembered. And finally, suggestion number 6, the best things in life aren't things. It's been said that success is getting what you want, but happiness is wanting what you get. Or, to put it another way, perspective next to money is the easiest thing to lose. So by all means, seek to increase your charisma. Try to become the most effective person that you can be. Work at making a good first impression and projecting a positive image, but also try to retain self-awareness. Look around you. Think how you appear to others. Be alert to the impression that you're creating, or at least trying to create. If you try too hard to impress or make a big to-do of a grand gesture, or you come on too strong or too insensitively, you'll often end up creating a negative impression. The best impression and the surest way to charisma often just means putting others first. It's been reported that one New York cab driver, for example, makes $30,000 more a year in tips alone than other cabbies. Why? Because he offers passengers a choice of several newspapers, cold drinks, or fresh fruit. He asks them what kind of music they'd prefer, and otherwise does his best to make his customers comfortable. In hectic, brusque Manhattan, small acts of decency make him stand out. So people with the most effective images often are those who are the least obtrusive about it. In fact, sometimes it's a simple act or gesture of courtesy, like announcing your first and last name when you see someone who may possibly have forgotten them, that burnishes your image, that really sets you pleasantly apart. Or maybe it's a short note of thanks for some favor, or saying something nice and genuine about someone. If never made, these gestures probably wouldn't be missed. That's why they're so obvious when you make them. In other words, being a genuinely good person who cares about others and who does things because they're the right things to do may be the ultimate key to increasing your personal magnetism, to increasing your charisma. Always do right, Because as Mark Twain said, that will gratify some people and astonish the rest. Thanks for listening.